This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Thank you very much, Roger, and good morning again as we prepare for another hour or so with you here on this Saturday morning show. Max Armstrong joining us a couple of times this morning. He'll talk markets with Terry Rogensack of the Hightower Report, and he'll also check in on another event that happened this week. And as we approach the end of the year, every year we come to the holiday season, and it's State Farm Bureau Convention time. And we have the Illinois Farm Bureau Convention getting underway. As a matter of fact, that starts today at the Palmer House in Chicago, and it'll go into next week. They'll be honoring many of their members, young and mature. In addition to that, they'll be determining policy that they'll take to the American Farm Bureau Convention in Phoenix in the middle of January. And as we say every year at Farm Progress Showtime in August, shake a farmer's hand. You'll have an opportunity to do that this weekend in Chicago. 5,000 to 6,000 of those Illinois Farm Bureau members will be in town. And this morning, Max Armstrong, who has been traveling, well, we always travel, don't we? Both Max and yours truly. He'll be checking in from an event in Coralville, Iowa, when we continue here on the Saturday morning show. Well, we're at about 12 minutes after 5 o'clock and right around the freezing level over this part of the Midwest, at least. We'll be watching that weather this weekend as some snow starts moving across the Midwest. But right now, let's find out where Max Armstrong has been traveling this week. Max?
Well, Orion, one of the stops on our busy schedule this week was Coralville, Iowa, for the Ag Data Conference that was held there. Sponsored by the publications Farm Industry News and Farm Futures, the Penton Agriculture Group. There were perspectives about all of this data that's coming in, how to pull the various pieces together. Whether it's information from those unmanned aircraft, or the soil data, fertility data, scouting farm fields, the harvest data that comes out of the farm fields. They talked about privacy issues and the contracts and various platforms that are used to aggregate the data and how you share the data and how you protect that data. It was very interesting. One of the people we talked with there was the editor of Farm Futures, Mike Wilson, from Decatur, Illinois. And I asked him a little bit about what they're writing in the magazine this winter, some of the articles that they are addressing. And he said the costs of production are the things that farmers are trying to get their arms around right now. And those are the kinds of things they're writing about in Farm Futures, as Mike explained.
The big story, of course, is that we have great yields, but we don't have great profits. That's going to be continuing the message throughout the winter, that we have to look at production costs, make sure the costs are top of mind for every producer who wants to be in business in 2017 and beyond. Our surveys all show that the highest profit farmers are the ones willing to go out and do things differently. We have in our current survey of farmers, they said that 61% said they were not willing to spend a lot more money on cash rent the way they had in the past because it just can't do it. The margins aren't there. And so they're willing to go back to those landlords and say, sorry, we have to do something else or we're walking away. So that's a little bit unusual. We also have been hearing from the bankers and the lenders that are a little bit more nervous this year. This winter is going to be very telling for some people. At the Ag Bankers meeting last week, I heard someone say that there are three groups of producers who are looking for financing. The top third, they're doing fine. Their margins are okay. The middle third may have to go back for refinance. But it's that bottom third are going to get dissected into two groups, haves and have-nots. They haven't been doing accrual accounting. They haven't been really paying attention to their production costs, and their working capital is starting to disappear. There may be some tough decisions made in 2017 if those producers are not willing to make some tough changes.
Are there some growers who are also looking at the option of maybe selling land and renting it back, something that perhaps was a part of their portfolio, a part of their asset base? That can be risky too, can't it?
Well, it sure can, and we've seen some farmers forced to retire early because as they look forward to the next 3 or 3 years and they don't see great margins coming, they're saying, well, my asset is my land. I will turn this into a situation where I may be retiring early, but now I have income from rental. Now I'll give that risk, that production risk, to someone else. So, yeah, we're seeing some difficult decisions.
I had a grower, in fact, reached out to me just about 2 weeks ago, and he said, I'm wrapping it up. You know, I'm going to get out of this business and leave it to a younger producer. He said, as you put it, he felt the time was right.
Well, you know, and you never know. Timing is so tough in agriculture. I mean, Michael Jordan got out on the top, but he's Michael Jordan. I mean, a lot of these guys probably wish now that they had jumped out in 2012 or 13, but it's the way agriculture is. It's cyclical.
Family living expenses are getting a closer examination, too, now, aren't they? And that can be some difficult conversations, but important conversations.
It's one of the stories we've been writing about in Farm Futures, and it's tough. When you talk about family living, that means you're talking with your spouse, that means you're talking with your kids, that means you may be selling some of your big toys like boats and things that you don't really have a need for in your production business, and so it's tough. It's tough. It's definitely tough, but if the guys who are doing that, they understand that they have to be putting their working capital to work in their business to stay viable for the long term. And I'm sure that families will understand that. I mean, it's their business, it's their livelihood.
Everybody has to be on board with that, don't they? And that includes using that piece of plastic that you carry around in the wallet.
Yeah, we've been seeing these numbers come down. There have been some numbers like $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 per year from family living costs, which are pretty high, but that number is slowly coming down. We've heard some pretty silly stories about people investing in condos, and you know, maybe it's time to get rid of the condo.
Mike Wilson, the respected editor of Farm Futures, as we spoke at that Ag Data conference this week, Orion. Mike also is the president of the American Agricultural Editors Association.
We're at 20 minutes after 5 o'clock on this Saturday morning, and this week, USDA came out with numbers that really didn't surprise farmers and ranchers across the country, because for the past couple of years, they have been living with lower commodity prices, and that's impacting their ability to buy farm machinery and other inputs needed for agriculture. And the word from the Economic Research Service at the U.S. Department of Agriculture this week shows net farm income expected to drop for a third consecutive year this year, down 17%. That would put it at $66.9 billion, due largely to weak returns for livestock, dairy, and poultry farms. The updated forecast from the USDA was down from its August forecast of $71.5 billion and down 46% from record profits for the sector. Back in 2013, $123.7 billion net farm income. And now in 2016, we're down to 66.9, down nearly half. And I have to ask a lot of you who are not in the business of producing food, fiber, and energy for this country, how tough would you find it if your income had been cut in half? And some of you are feeling the impact, because the weakening farm economy has triggered cost-cutting, job reductions at major farm input providers like seed and chemicals company Monsanto and equipment maker Deere, both of which reported lower revenues in fiscal 2016. And meat processor Tyson Foods last month reported a steep drop in sales and forecast further headwinds into 2017. So let's look at some of the categories. Cash receipts for producers of animals, animal products, including dairy, beef, pork, poultry, and eggs, projected to fall 12% to $166.5 billion this year. That would be the lowest since 2011. And Chicago Mercantile Exchange lean hog futures down by nearly 41% in the third quarter. That's the steepest quarterly decline on record. Cheap feed grains that encouraged a much expanded hog herd. CME live cattle futures fell 18% in the quarter. That's also the largest decline on record. Beef facing stiff competition at the meat counter from abundant supplies of cheaper pork and poultry meat. And then finally, row crop farming cash receipts were unchanged at $186 billion, thanks to some stronger returns for soybean and cotton producers, and that was offset by declines for corn and vegetable farmers. So, Chicago Board of Trade corn and soybeans have each notched new seven-year lows in 2016 because, as we've been talking throughout the growing season, there's a record large U.S. harvest. We'll get the final numbers on that harvest the middle of January when USDA comes out with final crop production figures for this current year. On the other hand, some good news, and Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack talked about it, that they're projecting exports to total $134 billion in 2017. That's agricultural products, $134 billion in 2017. Since 2009, the United States has exported more than $1 trillion in agricultural products, far more than any other period in our history. And according to Secretary Vilsack, the $134 billion forecast represents an increase of $4.33 billion from 2016. It would be the sixth highest export total on record. So, again, I hope that the people who are going to be occupying the key seats in our nation's capital will take note of the importance of agricultural trade, not just to farmers and ranchers in the United States, but also to our U.S. economy, because the export industry alone provides thousands of jobs to ship the product and to make sure they're delivered where they should be. So the good news and the bad news from USDA this week: farm income down, but farm exports continue to go up. What about the value of farmland? That's a question that probably comes up in every coffee shop conversation in rural America these days. With commodity prices down, what's happening to cash rent? What's happening to the value of farmland? Well, our farm broadcasting friend Lynn Kettleson, who serves farmers on the radio in Minnesota, also was wondering about that. He checks in this morning with a look at farmland values. Lynn?
Low grain prices typically equate to lower land values across the Midwest. And while that is the case this year, land sales are brisk. Chuck Wingert is an accredited land consultant and owns Wingert Realty and Land Services in Mankato, Minnesota. Wingert says prices for land continue strong across the region.
Right now we've seen actually a little bit of a resurgence. We've had a tremendous crop, and in spite of usually during harvest we see commodity prices go down, we actually saw a nice rebound, and attitudes have come around where we've actually seen some nice upward movement.
For the past couple of years, many investors have sat on the sidelines and have not been active buyers of farmland. However, that trend seems to be changing.
The investors who have been sitting on the sidelines the last three, 4 years and just saying, we see what's going on, we're just going to wait, some of them are coming back extremely aggressively and feeling, yes, that we might see a little more downturn yet next year, but you're never going to guess the bottom. And most of the buyers out there now are, they're buying for the next 10, 20 years. So they're looking at this as an opportunity to pick up land at a 30% discount and just sit and hold and wait for it to turn around.
And rental rates have been a hot topic of conversation in the face of little, if any, margins on grain at the moment. However, Wingert has not seen a lot of changes in rates.
We've seen some movement down, and if you talk to a lot of the agricultural consultants, based on these commodity prices, they really should be down further. But we're not seeing a lot of movement down, and the ones that are open for discussion holding pretty strong, 250, 275 on a lot of those.
With commodity prices generally low across the country, most people would think farmland values would follow. That's been the case in some areas, however, in other areas, not so much. One thing about it, farmland will always be bought and it will always be sold. This is Lynn Kettleson reporting.
Thank you very much, Lynn. And yes, indeed, it'll always be sold, it will always be purchased, and as Will Rogers said, well, maybe some of you don't even know who Will Rogers was, but he was a comedy philosopher that lived a long time ago. But he always said, when it comes to farmland, they aren't making any more, and so we're going to have to deal with what we have got. Well, we're going to take a break for the news at 5:30, and then when we come back, some thoughts on Samuelson Says. Max Armstrong will talk markets with Terry Rogensack of the Hightower Report. And Patrick Haggerty, who covers farm activities for us in Washington, D.C., will check in with his last visit with Tom Vilsack as Secretary of Agriculture. All of that coming up here on the Saturday Morning Show. Before we check in on the news, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, we named the 4 finalists in the AgCo 11th Annual Operator of the Year Award, Custom Applicators for Agriculture. Well, they announced the winner this week, and the winner is Tony Comder with Genesis Growing Solutions in Le Sueur, Minnesota. The 11th person to be honored over the past 11 years with that award. 5:30, and you're listening to WGN Radio Chicago. And good morning again at 24 minutes before 6 o'clock. And it's time to say welcome to Samuelson Says, sponsored by Wink Products Company, makers of quality specialty cleaning products since 1947. I'm Orion Samuelson. This week, some Cuban memories. The folks at Wink Products Company want to help make your life easier with a family of professional strength cleaning products. In other words, products that really work. Wink Rust Stain Remover is the number one liquid rust stain remover in the country. This professional strength formula dissolves the ugly rust stains on white sinks and toilet bowls, even color-fast fabrics and carpets. The little brown bottle has been around since 1947, and it's still number one. To learn where to find quality Wink products, check them out at wink.com. That's WHINK.com. The death of Fidel Castro late last month brought back several Cuban memories for me, dating all the way back to the early 1960s, when the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union was part of our daily life, when Fidel Castro overthrew the Cuban government and established a communist government just 90 miles off our shore. That was followed by the Soviet Union loading ships with missiles, shipping them to Cuba to put Soviet missiles 90 miles from our shore. But at that time, President John Kennedy said, no way, sent the U.S. Navy out to blockade those vessels with the missiles. They turned around and went back. But there was one night at least where we went to bed not knowing if we'd be at war the next morning with the Soviet Union. And the radio station where I was employed, WGN Radio Chicago, played a role in it because President Kennedy asked the station and other Clear Channel stations to carry a message from him to the Cuban people 5 times a night, every hour on the hour for 5 nights. And we did that. And within 2 months, Fidel Castro had put 250,000-watt transmitters on our frequency. And on the south side of Chicago, all you could get on the radio was Cuba, not our radio station several miles away. Then fast forward to 1999. I went to Cuba with Governor George Ryan of Illinois on a humanitarian mission, had the opportunity to visit with agricultural producers and importers, and learned that an embargo that we had imposed back in the early 60s wasn't working because we didn't control all of the products and other countries were providing them to Cuba. And so that embargo went on until maybe a year or so ago. It's still partially in place, but those are some of the memories I have. And the 1957 Chevrolets with paint colors of all kinds on the streets of Havana, Cuba. Also, we broadcast our radio shows from Havana Radio. Some memories of Cuba on Samuelson Says. A presentation of Tribune Radio Networks. Max Armstrong standing by to talk markets with Terry Rogensack after this, when we continue on the Saturday morning show.
Visiting with us this weekend, Terry Rogensack from Hightower. It's been a while. Good to see you again.
Great to be here.
Well, there's no shortage of things to talk about, but as we look across that landscape, is there anything exciting? I mean, you have to look back at the November rally we've just seen in soybeans, and that was kind of a nice surprise, wasn't it?
Yes, definitely. And it's been a demand market, a very impressive demand market across the board. China has been aggressively buying soybeans over the last couple of months, and it's really come from their impressive crush margins and their inversions that they've got. Cash meal is above the futures market, and the futures are all inverted. So that's really pressing the Chinese crusher to be an aggressive buyer.
Your longtime colleague, David Hightower, has gone over to China, I know, and has spoken there, participated in meetings on various occasions. You've long been bullish on China, but others were wringing their hands over the not-so-robust growth, not as much as we've seen in the past in the Chinese economy. Are you still pretty bullish on what you see over there?
We are, and we're also seeing Southeast Asia in general really picking up over the last couple of years. The Thailand and Indonesia, Malaysia, those areas, and Vietnam, we're seeing a very aggressive increases in their meat production and increases in their feed grain imports across the board, from aquaculture all the way to their expansion in poultry and in pork.
Sobering, though, are the numbers of production from the United States and what we anticipate from South America. Give us a little bit of a summary as to what you see there at this moment.
Well, the biggest problem short term, I think, is that the Chinese demand for soybeans is going to shift over to South America seasonally, which is normal. And we're eventually going to saturate that demand. We're looking at 500 million carry out here. And when you look at the bean versus corn ratio for next year, a lot of we've done central Indiana acres, dollars per acre, and we're sitting at beans favoring corn at the best level in since 2006. So the 5 million plus acres in beans looks like it could happen for next year, and corn might pull back some. One other thing on corn, though, demand, even this morning it came out that for 2017, over 900 feed companies in China have tried to get the import quotas for corn for next year. And with all the talk of the massive stockpiles of corn over in China, why would more than 900 feed companies and starch companies really want those import quotas? They're applying to get import quotas for 2017, so they want to import corn next year. So that might tell us something about the quality of those giant corn stocks.
There's been that chatter for many, many weeks that a lot of that stuff that's been sitting around for many seasons, a lot of that corn is out of condition. And this most recent report seems to perhaps add some credence to that.
That could be the case. And, you know, they've kept out a lot of DDGs and a lot of sorghum and a lot of, they're trying their best. But we're still sitting with the price of corn in China higher than the world market, and they're going to be attracted to imports. We do have a supply issue in corn coming with 24 million tons, if the USDA estimates are correct, 24 million ton increase in production, Brazil and Argentina combined, this year against last year.
And then the anticipation that we would have a big crop in 2017 in the United States, potentially. There needs to be a hiccup somewhere. You can't count on that every year, though, can you?
No, you cannot. You know, and the other, so a supply issue is certainly something that could happen very quickly, and you could lose 20, 30, 40 million tons if it happens in the U.S. or if it happens in China, if you get a 15% yield hit. You know, the other thing I'd say about demand, saw an article yesterday about feed grain demand. If China were to work their way up to a per capita meat consumption the same as Taiwan, it would take 128 million tons of extra feed grain just to reach that level.
Are they capable of producing within their own country that amount of meat, or would we also see correspondingly meat imports rising with China too?
That could be a lot of imports of meat and
they've got to be fed somewhere, though, don't they?
Yeah, they're not going to get 128 million tons out of China, no.
The Chinese buyers are shrewd buyers. I mean, they have a long and well-deserved reputation for that. What are they up to here in this fall of 2017, just after a presidential election, just before a change of administration in the United States, amid all of the saber-rattling that we've heard about trade and shipping jobs offshore, all of the talk that took place during the campaign? What are they up to here?
Well, there is a lot of theory out there that they've been more aggressive than normal and wanting to book those beans early in case there's some kind of trade war type issues developing with the Trump administration. We happen to think the bark is louder than the bite and that a lot of things are going to get smoothed out from all the rhetoric. But for right now, that's one of the theories that they booked ahead, and then they're going to end up with a period where their stocks are too high and they're going to need to wait until they start importing again.
A hole in demand would develop then. There would be this void. We've seen that before, haven't we, Terry?
Yes, and if we see that as South America produces an extra 5 million tons than last year into their harvest, then we could be in trouble. We're also hearing that South America, some of their early harvested areas are going to be starting to harvest as early as late December. So they're going to have beans available right into early January for shipment on the world market.
So the need to come to the United States for soybeans then would be pretty pretty small, because they'll have that bank to open up there in South America.
Yeah, and while meal is in high demand in China, they're just importing the beans and making their own meal to fill that void. U.S. meal basis is about as bad as it's been at the Gulf since 2012. A lot of talk in the U.S. that a lot of meal is sitting around at plants and they're trying to get it out there. So we're starting to see some cracks in the bullish setup for beans in the U.S. And we would not be surprised to see a pretty good break in beans unless there's a weather development in South America.
Well, let me ask you about soybean oil. Hasn't the bean oil market been providing a little bit of direction this fall? And does that relate back to something you were talking about earlier, some of those other Asian nations? I think of Indonesia, Malaysia, where they are big producers of palm oil.
Extremely tight palm oil stocks. And the fact that we're just now getting to the point where monthly production in Indonesia will be similar to a year ago and won't start really going much above a year ago until the first quarter of 2017. So with those extremely tight stocks that were drawn down over the past year, you can have all kinds of issues. I mean, it's going to might take some time to put in a top for the vegetable oil markets, but it looks like that's coming over the next month or so.
Isn't it a little more unusual for us to see oil driving the bean complex? That doesn't happen that much, does it, Terry?
No, it does not, and that's why we have a lot of concern with the meal activity in the U.S. and the slowdown in some of the exports we've seen there and the too much supply around.
The dollar certainly strengthened after the election, and that has become a factor, I know, in many parts of the world. Is that still the case? Is it still hurting our competitiveness in terms of exports of grains overall?
Yes, it can.
You don't seem to be convinced that it's been that big a factor.
Well, right now, corn is the cheapest corn in the world still, and U.S. corn is cheaper than all the other corn availabilities. But Brazil corn is coming down very rapidly over the past month, so we'll have to see when Brazil and Argentina corn get cheaper and when that might happen. And again, the corn production cycle really gets going later in South America than the beans. So you're talking about the second quarter is when we have to watch. And the USDA numbers really show a sharp drop off in corn exports for next year from this year.
Is wheat impacted substantially by the exchange rates? In other words, has that perhaps been a bigger factor, the wheat market more impacted by the strength of the dollar?
Yeah, that's probably the biggest factor when you're looking at Argentina wheat and Australia wheat coming on right now from their harvest, and the record Russian crop from last year, and the European wheat that's out there. The U.S. is the supplier of last resort, especially when the dollar is doing what it's doing.
We really have moved down the list, haven't we, from well, you know, 30 years ago, a pretty substantial supplier of wheat to the world. Now we're an afterthought.
Yeah, and from a currency point of view, too, we're in a rough spot for wheat. We've got a lot of supply around. The market's really, really oversold, but, you know, we got to wait till something happens production-wise around the world, and there's wheat coming all the time. The India situation is not as... The weather there is not as good as the trade has thought it would be by now, and that's a situation that we need to be watching.
Thank you for the visit. We appreciate it, Terry. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Terry Rogensack at our studio this weekend from Hightower.
It is 4 minutes before 6 o'clock, and in a couple of weeks I will make my annual trip to Washington, D.C., something I have done in December every year for 38 years to sit down with the Secretary of Agriculture and look back and look forward. And this year will be my final sit down with Tom Vilsack, who will leave that post as Secretary of Agriculture. But a few days ago, our man who covers agriculture in Washington, D.C., Patrick Haggerty, did sit down with the Secretary.
After interviewing Secretary Vilsack for his 8 years in office, I opened my last interview with him with the question, "Review your 8 years in office." He said, "Oh, that's a long list."
You know, we now have more opportunities for our farm families in terms of what they grow and where they grow it and where they sell it, what size of operations that they can be, how we can get young and beginning farmers into the business, far more extended opportunities there. The disaster programs and the safety net, I think, is more defensible than it was with the old direct payment system to the average citizen in this country. Our nutrition programs, obviously, are providing help and assistance to young people, and I can tell you that we're going to have a generation of healthier children because of the school lunch changes and the school snack changes and the WIC, Women, Infant, Children, package changes. Rural development, we've made an historic investment, nearly 6,000 water treatment and sewage treatment projects, 185,000 to 200,000 miles of electric lines that have been improved, hundreds of broadband projects, over 100,000 businesses help create and support nearly 500,000 jobs, unemployment down, poverty rates down, food insecurity among kids at its lowest rate. Food safety, we are saving lives, more lives today than we did 8 years ago with some changes that are historic and unique. So across the board, Natural Conservation Service, basically we now have a record number of acres enrolled in conservation projects. We're leveraging more resources from the outside in conservation. Our forest service now has a forest planning rule, first one in 30 years. We worked collaboratively with other agencies in a very innovative and creative way. So regardless of how you look at it, I think rural America is better off.
President-elect Trump has not named a new agriculture secretary, but this agriculture secretary wants to make sure that his successor will be ready from day one to run a large and important department.
And I myself am working on a private communication to the new secretary. Usually it's a one-page, welcome to the USDA, you're lucky to have the job. Mine's going to be 24 pages in length because there's a lot to tell this new individual about a department, because I think that even if you're the most tuned-in, knowledgeable person, you don't have a full understanding of the extent of what USDA does until you actually have the job.
Secretary Vilsack closed the interview by thanking the people he worked so hard to serve these past 8 years.
And I also want to thank the farmers, the ranchers, the people who live in rural America for their dedication to our country, for the working relationship we've had. I think it's been a good one, and I'm proud of the work that we've done, and I'm proud of the work that they do every day.
Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack sitting down with Patrick Haggerty and looking back at what he feels are accomplishments of USDA over the past 7 or 8 years. Well, again, we welcome Illinois Farm Bureau to Chicago for their annual convention. They'll be at the Palmer House. They're there right now and will be there into early next week. Iowa Farm Bureau will be meeting in Des Moines, Iowa, December 6 and 7. Indiana Farm Bureau will be meeting at Fort Wayne, December 8 through 10. And we're out of time, as usual, here on the Saturday Morning Show. Thank you very much for joining Max Armstrong and me on Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.